Welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, May 17th, 2021. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. Our top story, one of the top headlines, Bar Eatery Changes Name. A Dubuque business has enhanced its offerings and created a new brand in hopes of finding success in a post-pandemic economy. The Bar and Eatery, formerly known as Witch Sandwich, now is operating under the name Third Corner Food and Spirits. Owner Blue Coons said the new name alludes to the fact that her business is the third bar to operate on the corner of West 1st and Main Streets, joining Lot 1 and 1st and Main. The other corner at that intersection is occupied by River City Church. Three bars and a church, Coons said with a chuckle. You can't get more Dubuque than that. Coons, however, acknowledged that owning a bar and restaurant during the pandemic has not been a laughing matter. Business came to a complete halt in the early stages of the pandemic, and Coons has continued to deal with changing regulations and capacity restrictions ever since. It's been kind of a blur, she said. The money we brought in has gone toward paying rent and keeping the lights on. Under the previous moniker, most people thought of the business solely as a sandwich shop. Coons believes the new name will make the business more appealing to the bar-hopping crowd that comes to the Lower Main District for the late-night drink and food options. The branding is far from the only thing that has changed at the business. Coons' husband constructed a bar within the location. Meanwhile, Third Corner added a variety of spirits to a drink selection that previously offered only beer and wine coolers. Third Corner also changed its food offerings, introducing burgers to a menu that already included a wide array of sandwich options. Slowly but surely, the Lower Main District is returning to pre-pandemic form. Coons hopes Third Corner will hit the ground running as the crowds return. It is still hit and miss right now, Coons said. One Friday you'll be swamped, the next will be dead. You can feel things slowly coming back. Third Corner is located at 210 West 1st Street and can be reached at 563-451-7708. From chaperones to 65 years of marriage, a continuing series featuring the tri-state couples that are married 50-plus years. A chance encounter while chaperoning an orphan's picnic blossomed into a lifelong romance for Betty and Bob Dean of Dubuque, who celebrated their 65th anniversary last June. Betty, now 86, and Bob, 85, still recall that first meeting vividly. They explained that during the 1950s, the Illinois Central Railroad regularly hosted an outing for local orphans, who would enjoy a train ride to Dyersville, ice cream, games, and prizes. A friend of mine whose mother worked for the railroad called and asked if I would chaperone some orphans from St. Mary's, Betty said. Meanwhile, Bob's father also worked for the Illinois Central Railroad as a truck driver, and Bob usually rode with him to bring the ice cream to Dyersville for the event. In 1954, however, a substitute chaperone was needed, and Bob was recruited to chaperone 10 orphans from Mount Pleasant Home. As Betty and her friends supervised their young charges, the two girls noticed Bob and one of his friends standing nearby. I saw these good-looking guys, and I said to the little kids, "You go over and mingle with those other kids," Betty said with a laugh. The chance encounter sparked a courtship, and the Deans were married on June 11, 1955, in St. Patrick's Church in Dubuque. They moved to a home in rural Dubuque County with 18 acres. I turned it into a big old southern colonial mansion, Bob recalled. He went to work for John Deere and spent 17 years in the engineering department, followed by another 17 in quality engineering. Betty, meanwhile, worked for the Dubuque Community School District for 18 years in the preschool developmental program. We were getting them ready for kindergarten, she said. It was the best job. I loved my work. She also played the organ at Holy Trinity Catholic Church for 48 years and was the church music director for 23 of those years. After about a decade in their mansion, the Deans moved to a home in Lindbergh Terrace in Dubuque, where they would reside for the next 36 years. There, they raised their two children, Tom Dean and Marilee McCauley, both of whom were adopted as infants through Catholic Charities. McCauley fondly recalled how her mother would tell her the story of her adoption. She always would tell me how they were waiting for this little baby girl when I came on a plane from Colorado on a snowy day in April, she said. She always made the story so special and always made me feel very loved. McCauley now lives with her husband and two daughters in Virginia, where she works as a human resources coordinator for international law firm Jones Day. She described her parents as a cohesive couple who taught her and her brother the value of hard work. These are two people that are some of the hardest working people I know, both at home and in their work life. And they just did everything they could to give us a great childhood. Betty and Bob now live on Arbor Hills Drive, where Bob mows the lawn on a riding John Deere tractor and takes meticulous care of his yard and garden. I'll do a little every day, because if I do anything, it takes me a lot longer now, he said. I'm 20 in my brain, but I'm 85 in my body. In addition to his yard work, Bob keeps busy by painting and completing jigsaw puzzles. But he enjoys Swedish weaving, crocheting, and knitting. Each winter, she sends 30 knitted hats to her daughter-in-law, a first-grade teacher in Des Moines, who distributes them to children in need in her classroom. The dean's credited patience, respect, and forgiveness for their long and successful union. The secret, I think, in life is never to go to bed angry, because it's usually just a trifle, and it doesn't mean anything anyhow, Bob said. Climate data shows warmer, wetter local trend. Recently released climate data showed the past 30 years in the tri-state area were trending warmer in the winter and wetter overall than the data released one decade ago. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a science agency under the U.S. Department of Commerce, measures temperature and precipitation all across the country over 30-year periods, which are collected and checked every 10 years. The agency calls these measures climate normals. These normals are used as a measure to compare to daily weather events, as well as being used by other agencies and industries in planning. For instance, City of Dubuque Sustainable Community Coordinator Gina Bell said the normals were included in the city's recent vulnerability study. NOAA just released data for the 1991 to 2020 period, which allowed comparisons between it and the previous 30-year period from 1981 to 2010. Nationally, it showed a warmer climate than the older normals. Everywhere but the Southwest, it also saw increased precipitation. The entire country has seen a slight rise in those normals in the new period compared to the prior one, said Jessica Brooks, a service hydrologist with the Quad Cities District of the National Weather Service. That was expected, as we've seen the trends over the year, and our area had a rise in the precipitation. Looking at the data, the changes have been subtle. The numbers are wildly different, but there is a trend there you can see, Brooks said. If we're looking at the change in the annual temperature, you're looking at it up to a half a degree higher at times when you average all the temperatures. In fact, the average temperature, average high temperature, and average low temperature were the same in this data set as in the previous normals. It is within each season that the changes are clear. The biggest temperature changes in Dubuque can be seen in winter. There, the average temperature, average high temperature, and average low temperature are all warmer. That is in addition to the shorter spans of cold weather noted. Where your normal was 30 degrees or right around freezing for a week of the year, you're above freezing, Brooks said. In spring and summer, the new normals show cooler average temperatures than in the past. The summer months, June, July, and August, also show fewer days with a high temperature over 90 degrees. The changes also included increases in precipitation in Dubuque in every season. For spring, summer, and fall, the data showed more days with precipitation of at least 1/10 of an inch, more days with precipitation of more than 1/2 inch, and more days with precipitation over 1 inch. The data also showed significantly more days with measurable snowfall in the winter and more days with snowfall over 1 inch. These all mean more precipitation, but also more precipitation at a time. While these changes are all measurable and perceptible, they can be subtle, as experienced by the everyday resident. With precipitation, the numbers, again, aren't huge yet, but it is notable, Brooks said. We're looking at 5% higher than the previous normals. Bell told the Telegraph Herald that these normals point to increasingly and urgent needs for the city. It's going to be warmer and have more rain, she said. It's a lot of adaptation measures we need. While, yes, we want to reduce our emissions, we need to be more prepared. The B Branch project is a good example, increasing our ability to handle more water. So we will be looking at similar projects, if not quite to that scale. Bell said the next step is a plan and use of land near waterways. Are we increasing the floodplain because we know there's going to be more rain, for instance, she said? What relationships do we need? What infrastructure do we need in place? It's thinking about things like that. Communities at different latitudes along the Mississippi River could have experienced slightly different changes, but Brooks said the normals show very similar trends throughout the upper Midwest. In Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, the new normals showed average temperatures were warmer in the winter, summer, and fall, and unchanged in the spring. Average monthly precipitation was higher in all four seasons and annually. In Elizabeth, Illinois, both the average temperatures and the average monthly precipitation were higher in the new normals for all four seasons. Retired Dubuque attorney receives Eagle Scout Lifetime Achievement Award. Michael Coyle said becoming an Eagle Scout is only the beginning of an important commitment of service to a community. I tell new Eagle Scouts that they have to get on board now and give back, Coyle said Sunday. Coyle, age 76, received the National Eagle Scout Association Outstanding Eagle Scout Award Sunday during the Dubuque ceremony. They recognized 29 members of the 2020 Eagle Scout class for the Northeast Iowa Council, Boy Scouts of America. Coyle's award is a lifetime achievement honor that has been given locally only once before to former Iowa State Senator Tom Flynn of Upworth, Iowa. It is an award that's given to an Eagle Scout with exemplary service to their community throughout the years, said Anna Hudak, Scout Executive and CEO of the Council. It's a very rare, distinct honor. It is a nationally recognized award. Coyle retired from Heartland Financial in December. He previously served as an attorney and partner for Forsty, Carew, Coyle, Juergens, and Sudmeyer. His involvement with local nonprofit organizations includes work with Girl Scouts of Eastern Iowa and Western Illinois, Optimist Club of Dubuque, and Catholic Charities Foundation. He also was a past chairman of the board of the Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce. Coyle joined scouting as an 8-year-old and earned the Eagle Scout rank in 1959 in his hometown of Mason City, Iowa. He earned the rank before Eagle Scouts were required to complete community service projects. I kept with scouting all through high school, and then I gave it up, he said. Coyle was opening a checking account in Dubuque Bank after moving to the community in 1970 when he noticed a bronze statue of a Boy Scout on the corner of the banker's desk and learned that the banker was a local scouting volunteer. He asked, well, what about you? And the next thing I knew, I was on the local executive council, Coyle said. I've been here involved in scouting ever since. Coyle has served as a board member for the Scouts Central Region, Mid-American Council, and the local council. He has earned the Silver Beaver, the council's highest award, and the Silver Antelope, the region's highest award. He remains a staunch advocate for the role of scouting in society. We need scouting now more than we've ever needed it because of societal changes, the pandemic, and the political scene and world strife, Coyle said. This is just a solid organization. We just need the program to help the youth. Clay Carton, age 19, of Orville, Iowa, is among the newest scouts to earn the Eagle rank. Carton cleared about 60 tombstones at Orville Fairview Cemetery for his project and followed in family footsteps to become an Eagle. All four of my older brothers achieved the Eagle rank, Carton said, so the pressure was on. Another new Eagle, Dominic Camel, age 18 of Dubuque, installed an ADA-accessible water fountain at Four Mounds for his project, which had been impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. Communication was a problem because of COVID-19, Hamill said. Hamill said he was overwhelmed with pride to earn the Eagle Scout rank. It was my goal when I started scouting as a Cub Scout, he said. One death, three new virus cases in Dubuque County. The Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and vaccination. Sunday's developments included one additional COVID-19-related death was confirmed in Dubuque County between 5 p.m. Saturday and 5 p.m. Sunday. The death toll now stands at 209, the sixth highest among counties in the state. Three additional residents of Dubuque County were confirmed to have COVID-19 during the 24-hour span. The state of Iowa did not provide new county-level hospitalization data Saturday. The most recent data stated that, as of Thursday, three residents of Dubuque County with COVID-19 were hospitalized. Four such residents of Jones County were hospitalized, and one such resident of Delaware County was hospitalized. No such residents of Clayton County or Jackson County were hospitalized as of Thursday. Walk-in vaccination clinics are regularly scheduled in Dubuque County through Friday, June 25th. As of 5 p.m. Sunday, Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 1.7%. Rates in other area counties were Clayton County at 1.6%, Delaware County at 1.5%, Jackson County at 3.2%, and Jones County at 3.5%. Statewide, Iowa reported 138 additional residents with COVID-19 in the 24-hour period that ended at 5 p.m. Sunday, increasing the state's total to 369,368. The state reported six additional deaths, raising the total to 6,006. As of Sunday, 1,280,975 people have been fully vaccinated in Iowa, 51.4% of the state's residents who are at least 16 years old. In Wisconsin, a COVID-19 vaccine clinic will be held at the Crawford County Public Health Office on Wednesday, May 19th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. To schedule an appointment, visit www.crawfordcountywi.org/health or call 608-326-0229. The Crawford County Health Department will also be offering vaccination at the following schools on Thursday, May 20th. Prairie du Chien Public and Catholic Schools, North Crawford, Seneca, and Wazika Steuben. Interested individuals are encouraged to contact their child's school office to make an appointment. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services reported that a technical issue prevented it from updating data from its disease surveillance system on Sunday. The state had reported 605,926 total cases and 6,958 deaths as of Friday. As of Sunday, 2,423,858 Wisconsin residents have been fully vaccinated, which is 52.1% of the state's residents who are at least 16. There were 1,248 new COVID-19 cases announced Sunday in Illinois, for a state total of 1,366,268. The state reported 24 additional related deaths, increasing the total to 22,439. Illinois reported that 4,627,011 residents have been fully vaccinated as of Sunday, which is 45.3% of the state's population of those 16 and older. Trio of concerts to kick off Q Casino's outdoor summer concert series. Q Casino announced a trio of concerts that will take place this summer, marking the return of the venue's outdoor concert series. Kenny Wayne Shepherd Band will perform on Friday, June 25th. Shepherd, a guitarist and singer who dabbles in both blues and rock, has been a well-known musician since the release of his 1995 debut album, Ledbetter Heights. Brothers Osborne will perform on the Backwater stage on Sunday, August 15th. The band is known for combining country music with bits of soul. The duo, formed in Maryland, has been nominated for 7 Grammy Awards. It has produced a number of hits, including It Ain't My Fault and All Night. Alternative rock band Collective Soul will take the stage on Thursday, September 2nd. It is best known for its hit Shine, which has racked up over 49 million views on YouTube. Rock bands Tonic and Better Than Ezra will serve as special guests during the show. Tickets went on sale Sunday morning. They can be purchased at qcasinoandhotel.com or through ticketmaster.com. The top 10 Telegraph Herald's most read stories of the week. Crime-related news accounted for the most read article in 3 of the top 4 in telegraph.herald.com this past week. Below are the 10 most read stories on the website from May 10th through Sunday. Number 1, Dubuque County jury finds man not guilty of charges for fight with officer. Number 2, authorities ID motorcyclist killed in crash near Cascade. Number 3, Dubuque County supervisors repeal mask mandate. Number 4, police, Dubuque man arrested for sexual abuse of girl. Number 5, BizBuzz, Bellevue retail store opens. New burger option in Dubuque retail store opens new location. Number 6, authorities, 3 from Dubuque injured in crash caused by intoxicated driver. Number 7 is parent company of Dubuque Nursing Home to repay $214,000 over COVID-19 infections, employee practices. Number 8, Dubuque man given 30-year sentence for sexual abuse of girl. Number 9, Iowa to end participation in federal pandemic-related jobless benefit programs. And number 10, BizBuzz Monday, local boutique launches satellite location in casino. And now looking at our almanac section, for today being Monday, May 17th, it is the 137th day of 2021. So that means there are 228 days left in the year. And on this date in history, in 1972, the New York Stock Exchange had its beginnings as a group of brokers met under a tree on Wall Street and signed the Buttonwood Agreement. In 1946, President Harry S. Truman seized control of the nation's railroads, delaying, but not preventing, a threatened strike by engineers and tradesmen. In 1973, a special committee convened by the U.S. Senate began its televised hearings into the Watergate scandal. In 1987, 37 American sailors were killed when an Iraqi warplane attacked the U.S. Navy frigate Stark in the Persian Gulf. And in 1996, President Bill Clinton signed a measure requiring neighborhood notification when sex offenders move in. Megan's Law, as it's known, was named for Megan Conca, a 7-year-old New Jersey girl who was raped and murdered in 1984. Mayor, supervisor to leave roles but stay involved. Staying busy is a commonality between Maquoketa Mayor Don Schwenker and Jackson County Supervisor Jack Willie. Both will remain busy, but will do so in different ways. Schwenker confirmed he will not seek a sixth term as Maquoketa mayor. Meanwhile, Willie announced he will not seek re-election to his seat on the Board of Supervisors after serving for 3 decades. Schwenker plans to pursue Willie's seat on the Board of Supervisors when it comes up for election in November. "I've been in politics for 12 years, and this feels like the next natural step," Schwenker said. "I feel that we've got a lot of good things accomplished, and it's time for fresh new ideas." In his role as Maquoketa mayor, much of Schwenker's time has been spent on the city's infrastructure. The downtown Main Street reconstruction is completed, and next is Platt Street, which Schwenker described as the main artery through town. Schwenker said Maquoketa is really starting to develop a positive outlook toward the future and getting excited about the potential. Highlights of the town mentioned by Schwenker included the upcoming summer concert series in the downtown, the recent opening of Maquoketa Brewing, and the Maquoketa River Water Trail, which people can utilize for canoeing and kayaking. These neat things are exciting to think about for people who know Maquoketa, Schwenker said of the projects. When they come back, it's nice to see their reactions. In addition to the road reconstructions, Maquoketa is working on re-engineering the waste treatment plant and fixing the floodgates. The goal of the last half of the year is to stay on track and on budget, and we need to hire a new city manager, Schwenker said. We'll also encourage someone to take over as mayor to take the reins and continue the growth. Willie shares the focus of infrastructure as he said a new engineer was hired and upgrades to Jackson County's infrastructure will be made. Another upgrade for Jackson County will be a new jail. Willie said he recently received the revamped floor plan and they're hoping to break ground sometime this fall. The jail was in an awful shape, so we needed something better and different, Willie said. Those in custody have to be treated humanely. The Jackson County Courthouse has undergone some changes as well, with a new roof, as well as energy-efficient windows and lighting. A new camera and sound system in the supervisor office allows for live streaming ability. Being involved with this county is important to Willie, and he'll continue to work toward making it a better place to live. After I retire, I'll still find things to do. There's always somebody in need of something, Willie said of his future plans. A lot of people don't have the time or energy, but I'm in good health at this time, so I'm able to volunteer. Joe Davies officials pushing for county-wide housing study. Joe Davies County officials are looking to curb the county's housing shortage with a county-wide workforce housing study. On Monday, East Dubuque City Council voted 6-0 to approve granting $1,000 to funding the proposed Joe Davies County Workforce Housing Study being organized by Black Hawk Hills Regional Council and Northwest Illinois Economic Development. The two organizations are intending to hire a consultant that will conduct a study examining housing availability and demand in Joe Davies County, which could then be used as a resource to attract future housing developers by local municipalities. Emily Legal, Executive Director of Northwest Illinois Economic Development, said Joe Davies County is currently experiencing a gradual population decline, but many local employers also state a workforce shortage as a top issue in the county. We're always hearing that there is a lack of workforce, Legal said. The desire with this study is to have something that can show developers there is demand to create more housing in Joe Davies County. Daniel Piet, Executive Director of Black Hawk Hills Regional Council, said the Joe Davies County study is part of a larger initiative to conduct individual studies in six Northwest Illinois counties. Housing in the region has been an issue, and we want to quantify that, he said. We want to understand the issue with real data and be able to carry that to counties and municipalities. Pants said the Joe Davies County study is estimated to cost about $20,000, with Black Hawk Hills contributing about $10,000. The remainder must be funded through donations from local municipalities and residents. Loris Herrig, East Dubuque City Mayor, said he recommended East Dubuque City Council support the study because he believes it will prove a vital resource for attracting housing developers. If you talk to a developer, they will ask, why should I invest my money in East Dubuque, Herrig said. We can use this study to show that there is a shortage in all kinds of housing. Along with East Dubuque, Legal said Elizabeth Stockton Warren and the Joe Davies County Board have also contributed funds. When asked how much total has been funded with all the contributions from local governments, Legal declined to comment. However, Payette said the early support for municipalities in Joe Davies County indicates that the study will likely be funded. Once the study is funded, Payette said it is estimated to take about 9 months to complete, after which it will be distributed to municipalities throughout the county. Innovation is focus of Dubuque Museum Edition. The latest addition to a local museum's campus highlights the legacy of innovation along the Mississippi River. The National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium's John and Alice Butler River of Innovation Gallery will open the weekend of June 11th to the 13th. I never realized the type of innovation that happens in river towns, and especially Dubuque, said Kurt Strand, the River Museum's president and CEO. The $3.5 million, 9,000-square-foot gallery features a variety of hands-on exhibits and a makerspace area. Strand said the gallery tells a tale of past, present, and future innovation. You can look at the innovation that occurred with boat builders and the innovation that is continuing today, he said. The barge industry is innovating in different ways. Manufacturing organizations are, farmers are. The gallery talking about how river-related innovation impacts the world. The focus is on STEM. The gallery is housed in the location of the original Fred W. Woodward Riverboat Museum. The Riverboat Museum building opened in 1982 in the Port of Dubuque. Subsequent major expansions to the museum campus occurred in 2003 and 2010. Museum officials have been planning this major renovation for the past 7 years. The first phase of the project, an operational 19th century belt-driven machine shop, opened in October. The second and third phases open next month and highlight the areas of science, technology, engineering, and math. There will be hands-on offerings focusing on four major themes pertaining to innovation in and around Dubuque and the river, said Aaron Dragato, the museum's vice president of development. Once you have seen the history of boat building and innovation as it was 125 to 150 years ago in this area, you then progress from what was inboard engines to what happened to the advent of the outboard engine, and then you walk into the four themed areas. The themed areas provide visitors with information on tools, the changing river, including the lock and dam system, energy and motion, and vehicles and cargo. A holdover exhibit from the Riverboat Museum, a pilot house, has been spruced up and included in the gallery space devoted to vehicles and cargo. Instead of walking up and seeing a painted image adjacent to the pilot house, you will see a screen and will see a modern view of going down the river, Dragato said. Dragato said the makerspace provide an outlet for visitor creativity. By the time you've gone from the history to the Hansen exhibits and understanding innovation and what goes on around the river, hopefully you will be energized enough to make your own thing. Hundreds of dead bodies found buried along Indian riverbanks. Police are reaching out to villagers in northern India to investigate the recovery of bodies buried in shallow sand graves or washed up on the Ganges River banks, prompting speculation on social media that the remains of COVID-19 victims. In jeeps and boats, police use four loudspeakers with microphones asking people not to dispose of bodies in rivers. We are here to help you perform the last rites, police said. On Friday, rains exposed the cloth coverings of bodies buried in shallow sand graves on a wide, flat riverbank in Prayagraj, a city in Uttar Pradesh state. While officials say the riverside burials have taken place for decades, the sheer numbers in the shadow of the pandemic are focusing more attention on the practice. Navneet Sehgal, a state government spokesman, on Sunday denied local media reports that more than 1,000 corpses of COVID-19 victims have been recovered from rivers in the past 2 weeks. I bet these bodies have nothing to do with COVID-19, he said. He said some villagers did not cremate they are dead, as is customary, due to a Hindu tradition during some periods of religious significance, and instead disposed of them in rivers or by digging graves on riverbanks. Three hurt in two-vehicle crash in Dubuque. Police said three people were injured in a two-vehicle crash Saturday morning in Dubuque. Tiffany M. Davis, age 18, of Dubuque, was transported to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, and Ashley B. Black, age 37, and Susan Black, 66, both of Dubuque, were transported to Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital for treatment of their injuries, according to Dubuque Police. Police said Ashley Black and Susan Black were passengers in a vehicle driven by Amanda S. Black, age 31, of Dubuque. Davis attempted to turn right onto Hill Street from University Avenue when she lost control of her vehicle. The vehicle hopped over the median and struck Amanda Black's vehicle, which was traveling north on Hill Street. Davis was cited with failure to maintain control, no valid driver's license, and no insurance accident related. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, May 17th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Harold Aloysius Mueller, age 89, of Garnavio, Iowa, died Friday, May 14th, at River Living Center in Gutenberg, Iowa. Harold was born in Clayton County, Iowa, to Herman and Margaret Mueller on December 8, 1931, the youngest of six children. In March of 1952, he was drafted into the United States Army, where he proudly served his country as a corporal frontline jeep driver in Korea during the Korean War. When he returned from the war, he continued to farm until his retirement. Harold was a member of the Garnavio Legion Post 0723. Harold looked forward to and enjoyed his yearly reunion with his best Army buddies, Bob Leonard and John DeJong. In his free time, he enjoyed puzzles, fishing, traveling, gardening, country music, and visiting with family and friends. On September 18, 1957, Harold married the love of his life, Lois Schaffers, at Sacred Heart Church in Volga, Iowa, and to this union, 5 children were born. Left to honor and cherish his memory are his devoted wife of 63 years, Lois, and their children, Joyce Smarting of St. Olaf, Iowa, Sue Bosworth of Charlotte, Michigan, Doug Mueller of Muscatine, Iowa, and Stan Mueller of Sherrill, Iowa. 6 grandchildren, Nathan Marting, Ryan Marting, Ben Bosworth, Sam Bosworth, Adam Mueller, Emily Mueller, and 6 great-granddaughters, Noah, Ella, Emma, Hannah, Azalea, Riverly, 1 brother, Henry Mueller of Garnabio, as well as many nieces and nephews. Harold is preceded in death by a daughter, Karen, in infancy. His parents, siblings Dorothy Burns, Herman Mueller, Margaret Schluter, and Florentina Breeze. The family would like to thank Dr. Hoffman, Mary Eelberg, and the staff and tenants at Rivers Living Center for all their care, compassion, and friendship. In lieu of flowers and all types of sympathy, the family wishes that all memorials be sent to P.O. Box 484, Garnavio, Iowa, 52049. Arrangements are being handled by Chuck Allen Funeral Home at 207 South 1st Street in Gutenberg, Iowa, where the family will receive friends from 4 to 7 p.m. today. Funeral service will be at St. Joseph Catholic Church at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 18th. Reverend Marvin Breeze officiating. Interment will be at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Garnavio, Iowa. Homer D. Lindholm, age 92, of Belmont, Wisconsin, died May 13th. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11:30 a.m. on Friday, May 21st, at St. Philomena Catholic Church in Belmont. Friends may call from 9:30 a.m. until the time of Mass. Melby Funeral Home in Platteville is serving the family. Linda M. Brewer, age 68, of Cassville, Wisconsin, died May 14th. A private Mass of Christian burial will be held on Thursday, May 20th, at St. Charles Catholic Church in Cassville. Private burial will be in St. Mary's Settlement Cemetery in Cassville. Martin Short's Funeral Home, Lancaster, is assisting the family. Isidore M. Kowalski, went by Izzy, age 90, of Cuba City, Wisconsin, died Friday, May 14th, at Epiome Pavilion in Cuba City, Wisconsin. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 18th, 2021, at St. Rose of Lima Church in Cuba City, Wisconsin, with Reverend David Flanagan officiating. Services will be live streamed through Facebook on the funeral home page. Burial will be in the church cemetery. A public visitation for friends will be held from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Tuesday at the church before the service. The family suggests you utilize Mass during the duration of your visit in the church. Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Izzy was born on October 20, 1930, in Dickeyville, Wisconsin, the son of Jacob and Catherine Kowalski. He married Helen Miller on September 13, 1958. She preceded him in death on April 27, 1961. He married Diane Sincock on October 12, 1968, in Menominee, Illinois. Izzy was a lifelong farmer. He enjoyed fishing and was an avid Green Bay Packers fan, enjoying the games with his brother Leroy while drinking a Potosi beer and having a celebratory cigar. Izzy's faith was very important to him. He was a quiet, easygoing man who enjoyed the simple things in life. Survivors include his wife, Diane Kowalski, in Cuba City, a daughter, Gail Rogerman, in Menominee, a son, Brian Kowalski, in Cuba City, 2 grandchildren, Kelly Rohrman and Lindsay Hagerman, and 1 great-grandchild, Tate Hagerman. He was also preceded in death by his parents, 3 sisters, Dolores Quinn, Ramona Bodie, and Bernadette Jansen, 4 brothers, Victor, Norbert, Eugene, and Leroy Kowalski. The family wishes to thank the staff at Epiome Pavilion. In lieu of flowers, an Isidore M. Kowalski Memorial Fund has been established. Cards may be sent to Casey McNett Funeral Home at 123 North Jackson Street, Cuba City, Wisconsin, 53807. Online condolences for the family may be left at www.caseymcnett.com. Now moving back into news, doctors fear COVID-19 vaccines are messing with mammograms. After more than a year of anxious waiting, women newly vaccinated against COVID-19 are flocking back to mammography clinics to catch up on routine tests that were delayed by the pandemic. In some cases, they're met with one more pandemic surprise, a false red flag for breast cancer. Like a sore arm or a slight fever, lymph nodes enlarged by the immune system's response to a COVID-19 vaccine are virtually always a sign that the shot vaccine is doing its job. But to the medical specialists who scour mammograms for signs of malignancy, the unexplained appearance of swollen lymph nodes typically has sparked concern and a recommendation that the patient be called back for further testing. The result has been new uncertainties for women and the doctors who care for them. If it's a false alarm, women certainly don't need the worry-inducing call reporting an abnormal reading on their mammogram, and few welcome the additional tests that tend to follow. But as much as doctors wish to spare their patients unnecessary angst, they also want to avoid missing a signal that could be important. "It's a bit of a balancing act," said Dr. Lisa Mullen, a breast imaging specialist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. With many basic questions about the rash of enlarged lymph nodes still unanswered, the world of breast cancer screening has been forced to call some audibles. The radiologists who scour mammograms for signs of cancer are not easily rattled. They examine thousands of breast images each week and make lots of judgment calls. It's not very often they are downright flummoxed. On a typical pre-pandemic day, Dr. Hannah Milch at UCLA Medical Center might have seen one screening mammogram ambiguous enough to recommend further testing. In those cases, rarely involved swollen lymph nodes in a woman without a notable risk for breast cancer. In fact, radiologists say those axillary lymph nodes are usually elusive. Studies have shown that no more than 0.04% of mammograms reveal enlarged lymph nodes in women with no other signs of illness or malignancy. Tucked into the armpit, they are more likely to recede from a mammogram image than to photobomb it. But after COVID-19 vaccines began to roll out and healthcare workers and older women, the ones at greatest risk of breast cancer, began to pour in for mammograms, Milch started recommending callbacks 5 to 7 times per day. In most cases, they were for adenopathy, lymph nodes that seemed unusually enlarged. Mitch's colleagues reading mammograms across the country were seeing the same thing. "I thought, what is going on here?" she said. It definitely stimulated conversation. An unheralded piece of human anatomy, the body's lymphatic system plays a key role in collecting and removing cellular debris from the body. Like rubbish bins set out along well-traveled corridors, the lymph nodes will bulge noticeably if some unusual process is generating more trash than usual. When the body is fighting an infection, or thinks it is after a dose of vaccine, the immune system dispatches an army of cells and proteins to mount a defense, leaving a lot of detritus in its wake. Cancer, too, mobilizes a lot of cellular machinery. It uses the lymphatic system to travel to distant sites and leaves behind a telltale mess. Close to both the breast and whichever arm gets a jab of vaccine, the 10 to 20 lymph nodes inside each armpit can act as a sentinel when radiologists see signs that they are swollen. But whether a node is enlarged due to infection, vaccine, trauma, or cancer is not always clear. To gain clarity on that life or death question, a woman is usually called back for an ultrasound or a biopsy, in which tissue is removed from the breast for further testing. "Getting that call strikes fear in the heart of the woman who gets it," said Dr. Philip M. Bretzky, a Santa Monica primary care doctor. "It's like getting an abnormal pap smear. You hear it, and then everything else goes blank." With COVID-19 vaccine now widely available and coronavirus cases declining, Bretzky has been urging his patients to get current on their breast cancer screenings. But he's made a point of warning them that if they do get a call back after a mammogram, the culprit is far more likely to be a recent immunization than cancer. Radiologists have long known that a recent dose of vaccine for shingles, tetanus, or flu can cause lymph nodes to appear slightly swollen. But the sudden appearance of so many swollen lymph nodes in so many women came as a shock. In many cases, so was the size of the swelling. "They seem to be more prominent," said Dr. Constance Lehman, chief of breast imaging at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. "We had seen mildly enlarged nodes with prior vaccinations, but not to this degree. They also tended to be much bigger on one armpit than the other. In one woman, the swelling would be seen only on the left axilla. In another, it would be all on her right." "It was the craziest thing," Lehman said. "Everybody said, what's this?" Dr. Devon Quasha has been on both sides of the emerging discussion. A primary care physician at Massachusetts General, she got a jab of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine in her left arm in early January. 10 days later, she had a medical workup to investigate pain in her breast she had noticed while nursing her daughter. Her mammogram revealed some very enlarged lymph nodes in her left breast. They were hard to miss and potentially worrisome. Her colleagues in radiology furrowed their brows and asked her more questions. When she recalled when she'd gotten the COVID-19 vaccine and in which arm, they offered reassurances and suggested a follow-up after a few weeks. Quasha became her hospital's first case of what she called post-COVID vaccine adenopathy. Even so, she urges her own patients to get vaccinated and to get their mammograms as soon as they're due. But she tells them, be forewarned that if you've had your vaccine recently, there might be some findings that you're coming to understand are likely benign. Enlarged lymph nodes were showing up in scans of other parts of the body too, Lehman said. Doctors and radiology practices everywhere were finding the swollen nodes in imaging studies of the heads, necks, and pelvises of recently vaccinated people. By late February, articles in specialty journals began to detail what radiologists were seeing. And by mid-spring, expert panels had been convened by the Radiological Society of North America and the Society of Breast Imaging. Women should be asked if they've been vaccinated against COVID-19, how recently, and in which arm they got their jab, the experts advised. If possible, women should plan a screening mammogram at least 6 weeks following her second dose of vaccine. Women who have had a previous breast cancer should get their shot in the opposite arm. Enlarged axillary lymph nodes could probably be avoided by getting the shot of vaccine in the thigh instead of the upper arm, Lehman noted. In the absence of other evidence pointing to the possibility of cancer, recently vaccinated women with enlarged axillary lymph nodes should be called back at least 6 weeks later to give the lymph nodes time to recover. Not all mammography practices have taken the recommendations to heart. Some advise women without breast complaints to put 4 to 6 weeks between a dose of COVID-19 and a screening mammogram. Others, wary of discouraging women from getting either the vaccine or a mammogram, are urging women to come in as soon as they can. While their members of both expert panels acted quickly to issue their recommendations, they acknowledged that the advice amounted to expert opinion without data, said Milch, who was among the authors of the Society of Breast Imaging recommendations. The new guidance was largely based on actual evidence generated in response to the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines. It's not clear yet whether Johnson & Johnson's single-dose vaccine will evoke the same response, nor is it clear how long it will take for the swelling in some women's lymph nodes to abate or whether their reactions will be more pronounced after the second shot than after a first. Radiologists wonder whether some configurations of swollen lymph nodes can be dismissed lightly, while others warn of something more ominous. And they wonder how women's lymph nodes will respond to COVID-19 boost shots if those prove necessary. There's a lot that's unknown, Mullen said. One message is clear. If a woman has felt a lump in her breast or is experiencing soreness around her breast or discharge from her nipple, she should get her symptoms assessed right away. Here, too, radiologists are quick to point out that the enlarged nodes they are seeing do not amount to a link between the vaccine and breast cancer. I see no connection whatsoever, Lehman said. There is not one bit of evidence that would even suggest that. On the contrary, she said, I like to think that this is as good a thing. In response to vaccine, the immune system is doing the work it's designed to do. After a year in which screening mammography declined by about at least 20% from recent levels, and when there's growing evidence that patients are being diagnosed with more advanced cancers as a result, women certainly should not skip their mammogram screening after getting the COVID-19 vaccine, doctors said, nor should they skip the vaccine for the sake of a mammogram. The truth is, this is something that has always occurred. Only the scale of the phenomenon has magnified. Understanding iron deficiencies in children. Today is your child's 12-month appointment, and you already know they'll get vaccines. But why do they also have a finger poke to check their hemoglobin? A hemoglobin test is done to check a child's iron levels. Iron deficiency anemia occurs when someone does not get enough iron in their diet. Simply put, anemia means you don't have enough red blood cells to carry the oxygen you need to different parts of your body. Toddlers are at high risk of this because they are notoriously picky eaters and often would rather drink cow's milk than eat green leafy veggies and meat. It's true that cow's milk is good for you. It's full of vitamins and minerals that kids need to grow. But milk is not a good source of iron, and it blocks the absorption of iron from other foods being eaten. It is recommended that toddlers do not drink more than 24 ounces of milk per day. You might not see any signs or symptoms of low iron at first, and this is why it is routinely checked at the 12-month visit and again before the age of 5. Early signs of low iron can present as behavior problems, such as outbursts or learning difficulties. It also is possible to see muscle weakness. Once anemia fully develops, your child might become tired more easily, start to look pale, or get dizzy when running around. Some kids will start to eat dirt, chalk, or metal objects. This is a rare condition called pica that can develop if iron levels are very low. When evaluating a child for iron deficiency, the first thing your doctor will do is ask questions about how your child is feeling, what they are eating, and how much milk they are drinking. If they are at risk for iron deficiency anemia, they will likely will get blood work done to check iron levels, storage of iron in the body, as well as the amount and sizes of red blood cells present. When iron is low, the body makes less and smaller red blood cells than it should, also known as microcytic anemia. Treatment for iron deficiency includes giving iron supplements. Your doctor will also recommend drinking less milk if your child is having more than 24 ounces per day. When your child takes these iron supplements, it is important to give them with a small amount of food, but not with milk or dairy products. It can also be helpful to take iron with orange juice, as the vitamin C and acid help the iron absorb. Usually, your child should start to have more energy and feel better in just a few days, but it can take 3 to 6 months of additional iron supplementation to build the iron stores back up to normal levels. The best way to prevent iron deficiency anemia is to follow your doctor's recommendations for your child's diet. Babies under 1 year of age should only drink breast milk or formula, as these are good sources of iron. Exclusively breastfed babies should try to eat iron-fortified food solids at about 6 months old. Most baby products contain iron, especially puffs and cereals, but look on the label to make sure your child is getting iron in their diet. After 12 months of age, when your child transitions to whole milk, limit them to 24 ounces daily. Offer iron-rich foods to your toddler. Most baby cereals and breakfast cereals sold in America have added iron. Other foods that contain iron include red meats, fish, egg yolks, and dark green leafy veggies, like spinach. If you have any questions about your child's diet, or if you're worried about any of these symptoms, make an appointment with your child's health care provider. This article came from Katie Voss, who is a board-certified pediatrician with Grand River Medical Group. CDC Director, mask turnaround based solely on the science. The head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Sunday defended the decision to ease mask-wearing guidance for fully vaccinated people, stressing that increasing political pressure had nothing to do with the abrupt shift in guidelines. "I'm delivering the science as the science is delivered to the medical journals, and it evolved," CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said on Fox News Sunday. "I deliver it as soon as I can when we have that information available." Under the new guidelines released last week, fully vaccinated people, those who are 2 weeks past their final dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, can quit wearing masks outdoors in crowds and in most indoor settings and give up social distancing. However, partially vaccinated or unvaccinated people should continue wearing masks, the agency said. The guidance also still calls for masks in crowded indoor settings, including buses, airplanes, hospitals, prisons, and homeless shelters. The sudden change sparked praise from those eager to return to pre-pandemic life, particularly those who see the new guidelines as a way to reopen workplaces, schools, and other venues that went dark during the pandemic. Yet concerns have been raised from those who say there's no easy way for businesses and others to determine who is fully vaccinated and who is not. Instead, many will have to rely on an honor system, as many states and communities have already been lifting mask mandates and improving virus numbers as more Americans have been shedding face coverings after getting shots. I would imagine within a period of just a couple of weeks, you're going to start to see a significant clarification of some of the actually understandable and reasonable questions that people are asking, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the face of the U.S. government's pandemic response, said on Face the Nation. The timing of the change also has faced questions. Just days earlier, Walensky had defended the agency's strict mask guidance in front of a Senate committee, where some Republicans on the panel described the CDC's guidance as unworkable. When pressed about the quick turnaround on the agency's stance on mask wearing, Walensky said the agency was not giving in to pressure, but instead needed time to review evolving science. "I can tell you it certainly would have been easier if the science had evolved a week earlier and I didn't have to go to Congress making those statements, but I'm delivering the science as the science is delivered to the medical journals," she said. To date, more than 156 million Americans, or more than 47% of the population, have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine, and more than 121 million are fully vaccinated. Calls mount for Gaza-Israel ceasefire, greater U.S. efforts. The U.N. Security Council and Muslim nations convened emergency meetings Sunday to demand a stop to civilian bloodshed as Israeli warplanes carried out the deadliest single attacks in nearly a week of unrelenting Hamas rocket barrages and Israeli airstrikes. President Joe Biden gave no signs of pressuring Israel to agree to an immediate ceasefire, despite new calls from some Democrats for the Biden administration to get more involved. His ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, told an emergency high-level meeting of the Security Council that the United States was working tirelessly through diplomatic channels to stop the fighting. But as fighting in Israel and Gaza surged to its worst level since 2014 and the international outcry grew, the Biden administration, determined to wrench U.S. foreign policy focus away from the Mideast and Afghanistan, showed no immediate sign of deepening its involvement. Diplomatic appeals by other countries for Hamas and Israel to stop their fire showed no sign of progress. Thomas Greenfield warned that the return to armed conflict would only put a negotiated two-state solution to the decades-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict even further out of reach. And in Israel, Hadi Amer, a deputy assistant dispatched by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to try to de-escalate the crisis, met with Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz, who thanked the U.S. for its support. Blinken himself headed out Sunday on an unrelated tour of Nordic countries. He made calls from the plane to Egypt and other nations working to broker a ceasefire, telling Egypt that all parties should de-escalate tensions and bring a halt to the violence. Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat, for chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, on Sunday joined Senator Bernie Sanders, a Vermont independent, in calling on Biden to step up pressure on both sides to end current fighting and revive talks to resolve Israel's conflicts and flashpoints with the Palestinians. I think the administration needs to push harder on Israel and the Palestinian Authority to stop the violence, bring about a ceasefire, end these hostilities, and get back to a process of trying to revive this longstanding conflict, Schiff, a California Democrat, told CBS's Face the Nation. Afghan ceasefire ends amid calls for fresh peace talks. A three-day ceasefire marked by violent attacks, most claimed by the Islamic State group, ended Sunday in Afghanistan and calls for renewed peace-level talks between the government and Taliban. Taliban political spokesman Suhaili Shaheen said the negotiating terms of the government and the Islamic Emirate, as the Taliban referred to their ousted regime, met briefly Saturday in the Middle Eastern state of Qatar. They renewed their commitment to finding a peaceful end to the war and called for an early start to talks that have been stalled, he said. The U.S. has been pressing for accelerated talks as it withdraws the last of 2,500 to 3,500 soldiers and NATO its remaining 7,000 allied forces. Even as the Taliban and government signed on to the ceasefire, which was declared to mark the Islamic holiday of Eid al-Fitr, violence continued unabated in Afghanistan. A bombing Friday in a mosque north of the capital killed 12 worshippers, including the prayer leader. Another 15 people were wounded. The Taliban denied involvement and blamed the government intelligence agency. In a statement Sunday, the IS affiliate took responsibility for the mosque attack, saying its fighters planted an explosive device in a worship place for disbelievers, Sufis, killing the apostate imam or prayer leader. The statement claimed 40 worshippers were wounded. The IS also claimed it blew up several electrical grid stations over the weekend. That left the capital of Kabul in the dark for much of the three-day holiday that followed the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, May 17th, 2021. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.